Hey, got the morning show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Finn Mackesy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Finn is a permaculturist. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Just call you a permaculturist?
Yeah, happy okay. with that.
All right, and we talk every few weeks on Monday morning about permaculture, obviously, and we're in a process of looking at the permaculture petals.
Yeah, the permaculture flower.
Which is not actually, people will be going, what do you mean by that? So what do we mean by that?
Yes, so most commonly it's known as the permaculture domains or the petals of the flower.
Yeah.
But it is, I guess, a permaculture framework that's used to think, I guess, more holistically about sustainability and kind of whole systems. And
yeah.
So last time we looked at the or I don't know if it's the first domain, but the first domain we looked at last week was land stewardship and land and nature stewardship, sorry.
Yeah.
And so we talked all about all the related things around that, about looking after the environment and around food production, et cetera, et cetera. So I think today I'm keen to talk about culture and education, another domain, I guess, as it were.
What are the other domains?
So there are seven of them, and we've got...
Can you list them just like that?
I can, yeah. Building.
Could you write them down?
tools and technology.
Yep.
Health and spiritual well-being. We've got finance and economics, and there is community governance and land tenure.
This is kind of everything.
That's the idea, is that... and again, I know we've talked about this several times, but permaculture is so commonly thought of as like, I don't know, a messy form of gardening or something like that. Whereas when you step back and look at a lot of the, I guess, kind of the theory and thinking behind permaculture, is it is about all-encompassing, because we can't really design or create sustainable culture if we are only thinking about one aspect of it. So the idea is that it is a holistic, integrated lens about thinking about society, about thinking about culture.
So the messy form of gardening, as you called it, it had a system right from the start. It was a system, a way of approaching issues, and I presume it's taken that system and applying it to
that
approach to all other aspects of our life.
Yeah, and we do need to appreciate, too, permaculture's been around for, you know, quite a long time now, too.
Yeah.
So, you know... almost 40 years, and so in that time frame there's been quite a lot of thinking and evolution and development as well. So so this is a framework that I guess has come out of has been around since 2002-2003.
Okay. And so, all right, we're looking at culture and education today, so what is, give us a bit more on that.
Yeah, well, so I guess broadly speaking, when I think about culture, I think about or maybe it's more useful to think about questions. So, you know, how do we know what's important? And it's often our culture that tells us what's important or not. And what are the values we live by? And how do we pass these on? All of those make up our culture, as it were. And, you know, there's not necessarily a singular culture. I think probably historically that was maybe more true to say in terms of smaller societies, you know, less smaller populations, and more coherence maybe within people living all in the same place. They shared a lot of the same values. Whereas today, because of the pluralistic society we live in, is, you know, even today we could think about Raglan as having probably multiple cultures. So another way I like to think about culture too is, what are the stories we tell ourselves, you know, about who we are, what matters, what's important, and what are the stories we tell about the way the world is? And a lot of those, I think, have become, ubiquitous. They're like the water we swim in, or the air we breathe. We don't notice it.
Yeah,
it's so common. Some aspects of it, I think, are really obvious, but a lot of it is very subtle. And so often we don't step back to ask ourselves, what is the culture?
I heard an interesting thing from a business leader the other day, who said a culture, and this is just purely from a corporate business environment, but the culture is when a decision is made, if there's no rules or instructions from a manager above, the culture determines how that decision is made.
Mm.
Yeah, which is a completely different angle, but I was kind of intrigued by that.
I think it is, but that's a really good way of thinking about it in terms of what are those inbuilt assumptions and practices and beliefs that we have that inform the decisions we make, and that's individually and collectively. And if it's not obvious why all of this matters in terms of, I guess, sustainable culture, is it determines, again, the actions we take, the things we prioritize, what we consider important and what we think and what we consider unimportant. And if our cultural values are about consumption and about, you know, kind of living purely in the moment and not thinking in the future, that's probably not going to bode well, right? We know of 26 civilizations historically that have got themselves into issues through basically overconsumption, kicking the can down the road, not paying attention to current issues and challenges and going, oh, we'll solve those later, we'll solve those later. And as a result, have undergone a range of different forms of kind of simplification. You know, they haven't been able to sustain themselves.
By simplification, you mean they collapsed?
In different forms, yeah. I mean,
so that's examples. A more dramatic way of putting it, but...
Yeah. But I guess in some form or another, I mean, you've got things like the Byzantium Empire, who over a series of, you know, a couple hundred years, they, as opposed to a more of a falling off a cliff kind of collapse moment, it was more of a steady decline, with each successive generation having, I guess, less material prosperity. But but they certainly simplified, that's for sure. Yeah. And so I guess the question that I'm interested in exploring here is, what is the culture of Whangaroa Raglan?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's an easy one, and I don't think it's singular, and it's also temporal in the sense that, you know, like it's changing. I think most people would say it's changing. But if we are going to look at that domain of culture and education, I think first we need to look at, you know, what is the culture of Whangaroa?
So you want to ask
thoughts?
Me?
Yeah.
So these days with social media or the internet, not just social media at all, the internet, we can be part of a culture that's not in our place. So so there's a lot more diversity of culture. But Raglan was always like that in the sense that there were always, well, before the internet became something we were on daily, there were lots of diverse little groups. And maybe that's why it's such an innovative place, because the different groups are rubbing up against each other, things like that. I guess the thing that I touch on, the innovation, because I think that's part of what happens here.
I would agree,
and it's not. Innovation's a word often used in business or corporate terms. They talk about innovation in that way. But this is more innovation about how we live. And you talk about, you're talking about the culture or cultural change. And if you've got a culture that's based on consumption, then that doesn't bode well. So one of the successes of Extreme Waste was the culture change or the behavior change that they created. Something that a council probably could, well, surely a council wouldn't have been able to achieve, but they did achieve. They came from within the community, understood it, and change the way that we dealt with our recycling. Not everybody. Some people didn't like it, didn't like the changes, generally older people. But they did have success with behavior change in the community around rubbish and recycling. And people come from all over the country and around the world to learn about that. Now, how did they do it? You know, even people from China have been here. A group of mayors were in Raglan a few years ago.
I think you've shared several things to my mind in terms of the culture. One of them is around sustainability, and that might not have always been the case, but I guess...
Yeah, I don't know when that started.
Yeah, well, I think...
Before I got here.
Yeah, and I think Extreme was definitely part of that, right? Another one I heard was grassroots. You know, just that kind of we the people almost, that kind of community-led, community-powered is, I think, a very clear part of the culture here, and I think arguably always has been. And some of that might be geographical distance. You know, Hamilton and I guess more recently Waikato Regional Council is that much, and Waikato District Council are that much further away. And so there's an outpost, you know, not quite, but, you know, element.
I have this theory that's kind of a joke, but it's kind of true, which is that Raglan exists because of Hamilton. Hamilton is such a monoculture that all the people that felt stifled by that came out here. And it's a funny way to look at it. It might be true, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think even taking a step back further is Māori settlement and occupation of this place is, you know, very different drivers. But, you know, another, I guess, part of the culture is that kind of coastal interface, right? So there's the surfing culture, but then there's also, you know, the fishing and this place is, you know, the harbor historically has been a place of incredible abundance. And so there's also those elements to it. And then there's the topography and the geography in terms of really good lines of sight across large stretches of land that made for, you know, good settlements in terms of pass sites and protection and things like that. So there's a lot of historic things that where I think the environment kind of dictated the culture, you know, the activities of the people who lived here.
That's an interesting perspective because I haven't looked at it from that point of view before. Well, certainly from the Māori culture, like Bastion Point and the Raglan Golf Course were the two sparks that brought us to where we are today in terms of redressing all the wrongs of the past in this country. But the physical landscape is something. It certainly is. It's kind of wild out here. In my kind of naive way, I'd say it's a wild landscape. But you kind of get a little bit more detail on that.
And there's this something that's always fascinated me. So disclosing a bit about myself is I've got a background in anthropology. That's kind of one of my passions. And in school, I studied about these people called the Western Apache of Turtle Island, of North America.
Yeah.
And they had this concept that wisdom sits in places. And so they used the landscape as a means of telling stories about their cultural values and about what matters. And so they would, as a matter of socializing the next generation, they'd move them around their local landscapes. And they'd say, oh, and at this place, here's this story that happened. And those stories of place always involved these rich, these stories imbued with cultural values, morals about what to do, what not to do, what happens when you act in certain ways. And I wonder what might happen if we started to think about landscapes in those ways again and where they started to tell stories again. And I'm sure within local Māori, they still do. But for from a more modern Raglan culture perspective is how many of our landmarks around the place are imbued with that much knowledge about I guess culture past and present.
One thing I noticed is that there are many more place names in the sense that I think part of the modern world we look on a map and say that's Raglan, bang, there, and that's Whangaroa, that big lumpy bit there. But they have names for the original Māori people who had names for like the spit of land by the skate bowl. Right.
They would have,
I think. I'm not going to try and say the name because I might have misremembered it. I don't want to get it wrong. But yeah, but like, and we just call it, we call it the place like, by the skate bowl.
Yeah, like Kopua and Papahua and, you know, those kind of place names.
Well, but more detail than that.
Got it.
Like the point of land, you know, you go across the walk bridge, you walk to the right, and that little bit of inlet joins the main inlet, and that the bit of sand there, that has a name, that actual point.
And I suspect it would have been imbued again with kind of cultural meaning, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. A lot of information. So every place name had it. Has a story behind it as well. And that's what I've been learning. Every little spot has a story. But we don't know them because it's on the map. It just says Raglan.
The mechanism for those stories to be shared kind of publicly and safely is probably it's changed quite a lot, in the last.
Well, the people who know the stories don't feel safe telling the stories, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because otherwise we'd know them.
Yeah. And we understand, you know, why that is.
Yeah, we
right?
understand. We do know why, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that, I guess, leads into the second part of this domain of permaculture.
Maybe we should say
education.
Maybe we should say because of the colonial past, that's why.
Yeah.
I thought you and I know why. I thought someone might be listening again. No, hold on.
Yeah.
What are you implying?
Well,
so
yeah,
I thought I'd just be clear.
I think that's good. And the implications, I guess, around cultural appropriation and and all of those kind of things, which impacts on our ability again to, I think, fully embrace and recreate a culture of Whangaroa for that's fit for purpose for this time and place.
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned innovation, sustainability, kind of grassroots. These are my words that I'm using. You used innovation to describe the culture of Fangaroa Raglan. Can you think of other, what else comes to mind, you know, in terms of, like, I think of a surf culture and maybe like an alternative kind of hippie kind of association with Raglan as well?
So there's an informality, if you want to use it slightly. A more generalized word, it is a much more informal place. Things like the builders start work later here in the day than the builders in Hamilton, which might be considered, well, that was a while ago, I haven't been involved in the building industry for a while, that might be considered to be an insult by some people, but it's just an observation that it's not all about the work. It's definitely not all about the work here.
So that's interesting too, is, you know, another cultural difference that is unique to this place. And, you know, it's not to say other places don't have it, but it's distinct from, say, as you said, Hamilton.
The other places that have it, actually, this is kind of interesting. I think of when I went to over to Golden Bay, over the Takaka Hill, I was like, oh, this feels familiar, right? And Waiheke, although it's become very rich lately, also had it. And so, and I realized those are all places, all places that are at the end of the road or isolated in some way. Like, I feel like calling it the Takaka Hill to get to Golden Bay, that's misleading. It's part of the Southern Alps. You know, it's like it's a real drive over there.
It is.
So, yeah, so that's another place that's isolated. Waiheke is obviously an island. Coromandel, it's a mission getting there, especially at the moment.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, so the relationship between geography and topography and kind of transport that creates these unique cultures of place where they are distinct from whatever the largest, biggest town that they connect to.
I wonder if those other places have got the diversity of culture that we have too, because it's weird, because Raglan's kind of a melting pot, even though it's the end of the road. You'd think Hamilton would be the melting pot with the roads going through it from all directions, but it's not at all.
It's not,
So
other things that come to my mind, and I'm interested in your thoughts around this, is, you know, there's definitely a farming culture here in Raglan, and there is an emerging food culture too, which I think is, to my mind, quite exciting, and that might be coupled to some of the kind of sustainability stuff.
Do you see the farming culture as any different from the farming culture anywhere else in the country?
I don't know enough to say. I don't know. But I think given how interdependent, generally speaking, kind of farmers are, that I would imagine there's probably quite a lot of similarity between, you know, farmers elsewhere and farmers here. But again, global supply chains and a whole range of things that
they're plugged into that.
That make that so. There's obviously kind of strong local Māori culture.
Yep.
Here, and I think that is one of the things that makes Whangaroa unique, is the way in which even non-Māori relate to and understand things Māori. You know, that's and people who have maybe lived their whole lives here might take that for granted, but that's not necessarily the case elsewhere in Aotearoa, even in this day and age. And arts and culture is another one that really stands out for me as being quite strong. And so I'm really interested in, you know, what's the role of education in all of this? Because what makes, why here, why Raglan, is none of these things are kind of universal, as it were.
Well, I was going to say it can't be the school system, because the school system is by design meant to be universal. It's the same throughout the country. Having said that, it's an area school here. A lot of people don't want to send their kids to it at secondary school age, but it is a small, has a bit more of a family vibe just because it's so small. Plus they sit there with the classrooms looking out across the waves, and some of the classrooms anyway. When you say education, I immediately went to school system.
But formal education.
But, I don't think that's got much to do with it,
no,
to be honest.
No.
But how does the education work outside of that system?
Yeah, and so
I'm asking you now.
Yeah, so historically, I'd even say today too, is obviously places like Marae are cultural hubs, right? And so that's where a lot of cultural values, cultural stories, all of that gets passed on. And obviously that still happens today. But I guess the way in which it happens might have shifted. And I'd say the majority of the people who live here probably don't have access to that in the same way. But that's certainly one way. And then I'd say there's, you know, clubs and extracurricular kind of stuff. You know, there's the whatever that is, excuse me, the arts and culture here is strong enough where, you know, you've got dance classes and drama theater and all these other things that
we have that now, but that really only started happening about 10 years ago. And certainly when our kids were really little, there was a lot less options. Although there were, I think the clay class had started when they were like in their primary school age. My kids are like 21 and 18 now. And there was, for the last 20 years, there's been a dance class, but before that, there was no dance class even.
And so that part is growing, you'd say, like the kind of the formal access for young people to develop passions and skills in those spaces.
Yeah, and we say formal, but it's not formal like a school. And a lot of it is in a much more loose sort of way. Like I know... Patty, who does the Whangarei Youth Movement dance classes, like I've talked with her a lot about her approach to it, and it is a lot more getting the kids to design their own dances, whereas one of my daughters for 1 year went to a dance class in Hamilton, and it was much more strict and straight down the middle.
So it's interesting there already we're talking about culture and education blending, is that you know, we've talked about this kind of grassroots and this community-led value that seems to sit here, and then how that shows up in things like dance class and already taking a different approach and a different way to try to support young people to, I guess, kind of feel their own sense of kind of movement and freedom within, I guess, dance as a form of expression, which is quite cool.
And did the local culture dictate that that's how the dance class would emerge? Did the local culture attract the person who created the dance class? Like, this is a little microcosm of everything else. It's just one that I know quite well.
And so I guess we're talking to indirectly to this point about, I guess, culture changing as well. You know, you were saying, you know, over the last 10 years you've noticed this change, and
it feels like maybe that you need a certain population size as well.
I'm not from an anthropological lens. I mean, you always have culture and you always have education. You always have ways of sustaining cultural values.
But for all these classes that you're talking about, maybe there's a critical mass.
I understand that in terms of arts and culture is you need enough people to... So I understand that. I was thinking more in terms of what sustains culture and, you know, smaller population densities, larger ones, they still have a culture that kind of changes and morphs over time. We talked before this about some of the changing dynamics of Whangaroa, and I guess particularly around, you know, this new wave of migration, but also of increasing cost of living here.
Yeah,
and the impact that that has on culture.
Yeah, so I've tried a lot to figure out what is unique about Raglan culture, and often I'd ask aspiring politicians about those sorts of questions as well, but in the end I had to start answering it myself. And the thing that is unique about Raglan, I think, came from the poor people, not the rich. Comes from the poor people, not the rich people, or the people with time. If you're super busy working or owning a business, which really takes up your focus, I don't think you're contributing as much to the unique culture of Raglan. I think if you're a surf bum, an artist, a musician, you're present here rather than going over the hill to Hamilton as well to work. I feel like that's what's a part of what's created this culture that's fairly unique in Raglan. And as it becomes harder and harder for low-income people to live here, are we going to lose that culture? There's a question I've been asking. I don't really know, but it certainly feels like it's changing. I've been here long enough to feel it changing.
And it's interesting. It feels like we're on the edge of talking about, you know, some of the other domains of the permaculture flower, things like finance and economics, and how that plays into culture. And you can see how those two are kind of related in some ways too, even around, you know, the value of consumption or earning lots of money, and how those play into that economics and finance thread. But there's also things, you know, stuff that I've noticed, trends. You know, there's not enough housing for locals, and there's, you know, 5-10 people a week on the Raglan notice board saying, hey, I'm looking for accommodation or I want to move here. And, you know, we're starting to move both into finance and economics, but also into the building domain. and what are the potential implications for the culture of Raglan as more and more people want to move here.
Well, if it becomes a place only rich people can live, that will profoundly change the culture. Mm. But having said that, we have this problem in every town in the country, practically. Mm. Maybe there's some little places in the middle of the North Island that aren't like this, you know, that we're forgotten about. But pretty much the whole country is suffering from this. So I'm not quite sure what that will mean. And it has... So I feel like that has the potential to breed some really unusual cultures. You might get groups of people living together in abandoned buildings or, I don't know, really weird places, grouping together for mutual support. And that will definitely drive some unique cultural moments. I'm not saying that'll happen here, but it just kind of occurs to me now.
Yeah, well, you'd need those abandoned buildings to be able to,
well,
for that innovative response to emerge.
Some abandoned forests, maybe. I don't know. It will force some change, though, eventually.
And so I think in the education space is, you know, some of this is about how do we, or what are the opportunities to be proactive and to ensure that the values and the skills, the capabilities, the capacities that a culture wants to either develop and or maintain are passed forward. And so we talked about formal education.
Yeah.
But what's the role of like informal education? So things like, you know, apprenticeships, mentoring, you know, tua kanatena type relationships. And I know those have been a big part of at least some of the subcultures that I'm familiar with here around, the permaculture community and kind of more the sustainability community. I know it's been a part of that. I know there's initiatives now where professionals are sharing their skills and they're with young people, you know, so there are, there's kind of Wananga programs up and running where, as an example, electricians are teaching teenagers, you know, the basics of how to work with
circuits. So where is that happening?
So that's an initiative that I think is, it's happened at different places over the last 6 to 12 months.
Around New Zealand?
No, that's here, specifically in Whangaroa.
Oh, okay.
And so I know of, and I know of other people who are sharing
skills. Actually, I'm not aware of that. That's interesting.
And I know of, you know, similar things around architecture where you've had retired architects who, there's young people who are wanting to learn the basics. And so they're doing kind of tutorials one-on-one and just sharing some of the basics and passions. So I notice, and I know a lot of that kind of things are happening, and then some of it's more formal than others. And then there is informal education that's happening. You know, there's a kind of quite a diverse homeschooling kind of network here in Whangaroa.
Yeah.
People who are wanting to or choosing to educate young people outside of the state schooling system. But then there's also alternatives to that as well. So like there's quite a few what I'd call maybe nature education or kind of bush education stuff.
Yeah.
Kurutayo is probably the best one, Rob's, and
you know,
the good work he's doing there. And if I understand it right, is, you know, that's at the stage now, not just that initiative in particular, but the Ministry for Education is recognizing the value of it. And so saying, oh, if your child is in state education, they can take a day off a week and go do, you know, some kind of nature education that the school that they're going to isn't able to offer.
Yeah.
And so I think that's another really key way in which some of the cultural values and the skills and aptitudes that you might want and that I would say are really important for Raglan moving forward are get to be maintained.
Well, I'm actually really interested in that area because there's kind of three entities at the moment, at least, who are doing that. We have been for a little while. One is Kurutaya. One is the parenting with nonviolence that Te Maurito is evolving for the situation in this country. And the third is the Potama rites of passage that Maddie and Tiaki have and now a big crew around them have got going.
Yeah.
And the thing I was looking at is one thing about Raglan is we live in the future in a weird way.
Mm.
We live in the future. 25, 30 years ago, extreme zero waste and Whangaroa Harbour Care were getting going.
Mm.
And people thought they were a bit crazy. And then now the founders of those organisations are consultants for other organisations all around the country.
Mm.
You know, and so back then when everyone thought it was weird fringe stuff, now it's become normal. And I think the reason I mentioned those three organisations together because it's all about how we treat our children, how we raise our children, and that's all part of this education you're talking about. I guess it's a hope for the future that what these three organisations are doing becomes stuff that everyone else looks to after a time and sees as something that we want to spread around the place.
And I guess one of the take-homes for me is around the, you know, if we're not investing in our culture, if we're not investing in educational initiatives that support that culture, we're at the whim of larger powers, larger forces. So, you know, global consumption culture is, of course, know, knocking at the door at all times. And what, you know, the things that make Whangaroa unique and distinct now aren't always necessarily going to be that way unless there's a group of people who are kind of stewarding and investing in the future culture. And again, education is one means by which we kind of maintain, sustain, and even develop.
Yeah, and it actually feels quite hard. Like, I get the concept. It's quite hard to say, okay, now come up with five ideas that are going to do that education, because a lot of education too happens in such an informal manner. Like, I homeschooled my kids as well, or unschooled them.
Yeah.
So, and it's a unique situation to watch them grow and learn things seemingly out of thin air. That's a lot of stuff they just picked up and they didn't know where they'd got it from. I couldn't tell where they'd got it from. They just suddenly knew things. It was very strange, but other parents who've done the same thing talk about that happening as well. And so how do you institute something that enables that process to work when you don't even know what's happening, you know? Most of our education is even for kids who go to school, is informal about how to live life.
That's
how to behave,
that happens. Yep.
And your values, which you can't even say what they are sometimes until you go through a process to figure out what they are.
So I think there's a few things to my mind, but one of them is around community conversation.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, one initiative here is there was a group that formed called Rebel Education. And I know a lot of people sitting around just having a conversation around, you know, what alternatives to current education opportunities might look like. And of that has blossomed this whole other kind of grassroots community, kind of youth-focused community initiative, which is quite cool. And I know there was this really awesome project when I lived in Golden Bay. A man named Alan Fricker ran. It was called Community Conversations. And he was one of those people who had the mana that he could bring a whole bunch of diverse people together into the same space. And there was a real diversity of people who wouldn't otherwise mingle with each other. And he used to have these conversation starters. And they were around a whole range of things that were, you know, they might be philosophical or spiritual in nature, but they were something that everyone would have some kind of opinion or relationship to.
Yeah.
And he used it as a means of trying to bring together and create more resilience and more collaboration in a community that, you know, had some friction and some tension. And I thought that was fantastic. And the whole purpose of those conversations wasn't to agree on anything necessarily. It was just to be able to share diversity of opinion and to see that actually, at the end of the day, we're all kind of human. And I think that initiative was hugely successful. And I learned a lot from participating in that process. And one of the things he did at the end often is he'd say, okay, now look around the room and see someone who you don't know very well. And I invite you to go up and invite them out for a cup of tea between now and our next chat. You know, I can give you a conversation to talk about if you want, but otherwise, just go have a conversation.
Did you do that?
I did.
I imagine you would, knowing you. Yeah, you'd be the first one.
I did, and I learned a lot because, again, I spoke with a whole bunch of people in quite an intimate way, you know? There wasn't, you know, it wasn't at a party where you could kind of go, ooh, I'm not connecting with this person, I'm going to quickly ditch this
conversation. Oh, someone over there waving at me.
Was, you know, it lasted as long as it lasted, and so you'd kind of, I learned a lot about how to just be with other people, even if I didn't agree with them. And I reckon some of those things are some of the cornerstones of healthy culture. You know, we need to be able to disagree in order to be able to eventually agree.
We do have a bit of a problem with that at the moment, more than we have in the past. So
So hopefully this has kind of been a little bit insightful in terms of why culture and education is kind of like a domain within permaculture and its role in helping to foster, I guess, sustainable culture.
Yeah. No, it does create, because it's quite hard to pin down some of this stuff. So that's the importance of the conversation.
Agreed.
Yeah. In fact, culture is very hard to pin down. What it is exactly.
It's
ask
really
10 people
amorphic.
What our local culture is, you probably get 10 different answers.
And maybe that's a conversation starter for a community conversation.
In fact, I've had that experience. When Raglan Naturally was the document was being rewritten a few years ago, there was an event in the town hall, and I went around interviewing people informally. And I was getting a lot of surprising answers, things that had not really impacted me as being important to what was important for the community. Mm. But other people clearly felt certain things were important that I was not on my radar. So, for sure, yeah. Hey, look, we've gone over time, but I thought I'll trim the show for the repeat tomorrow. So, folks, we've been talking to Finn McAsey. We're talking permaculture and the permaculture flower, the domains, and this is the culture and education domain, and it all ties back to the system approach of permaculture, we call it that.
Yep.
Yeah. So thanks for coming in, Finn.
Thanks for having me, as always.